there's a standardized procedure for doing this, that the materials are standardized, and that everybody is required to do this, basically, and also that the liability associated that with the administration of those vaccines is done in an equitable manner, so that if the child receives the vaccine at the health division, at the health department here in Marion County, for example, that and if there's an adverse reaction to the vaccine, that or they receive it in my office, for example, or some other physician's office in the state, that their liability is going to be on the same ground, and that for some reason the private doctors may not be looked on as a deep pocket, for example, that we're all on the same ground. Just to remind you, one other quick fact, right now in the state of Oregon, we're running at about a 55% immunization rate, so it means that 45 to 50% of our children are unimmunized properly. They get caught up by the time they get to school because they can't enter school. But in that first 5 years, we're one of the worst states in the union right now. And this is, like I said, one way to address this problem. It's not going to be the only way to address the problem. There has to be better public education and other outreach programs.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions?
Madam Chair, I had one final point I was going to add.
Okay, sir, have you a question?
No, simply deja vu, because I voted against the mandating of vaccinations just for this reason, the adverse reactions. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the one final point I was going to make was that the bill in its current form now is very similar to the minority report that came out last session, was supported by the trial lawyers, in that we have removed the manufacturers from the bill, and that the cap on damages remains at $250,000, as it did last session in both the committee bill and in the minority report bill that came out.
You, by removing the manufacturers, the committee members, you mean you haven't...
The manufacturers,
to them to this kind of,
they will not receive any liability protections at all in this legislation. The manufacturers will not. That was the result of some compromise amendments that the trial lawyers and the OMA agreed to on the House side.
Okay. So we're just now talking about whether the 250 corresponds to the federal on administrators.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, we feel that it's important that the cap at the state level correspond to what's there at the federal level, in that we don't set up essentially a situation where you're encouraging someone to reject the federal award to go out and pursue it in state courts. Individuals have to their discretion the ability to accept or reject the federal compensation, and so they can still pursue that in the state courts. And we feel that it would make sense to have it consistent with the federal and the state law, so that you don't set up essentially an incentive for an individual to reject the federal award that has been set up to essentially compensate the victims of these, these tragedies.
Excuse me. One last comment. Right now, presently, about 30% of children are receiving the vaccines through the health department. We'd all be very happy if the state would go out and contract and give all children all the vaccines and take that out of our offices. We'd be extremely happy with that. As it is, we're doing about 70% of that right now. So, again, it's a request to control the liability associated with the administration of the vaccines.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions?
Question. Needless to say, I'm going to support the bill. I mean, I have no problem with it. But perhaps, Doctor, you can explain to me, since it's been quite a while since I've been in this situation, the precautionary measures that are taken prior to the vaccine being administered outside of, other than questioning the parent. Are there any other precautionary measures taken?
Well, for example, if we have a child who has an unstable neurological condition, it's a two-year-old who has uncontrolled seizures, he's got some problems with cerebral palsy, he's got something that we're not sure or that's not diagnosed, we would say don't vaccinate that child.
The normal appearing child.
With a normal appearing child, if there's no family history, there's nobody else that's had any weird reactions or unexpected reactions to vaccines in that family, and there's nothing that the parent can recollect that has any bearing on the administration of the vaccine, then we would just go through the whole list of these potential reactions with them. The parent still has the option to say, I don't want them.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have parents that say, I don't want them. Mm-hmm. We do tell them that they are going to have to talk with the health department about this and how they're going to resolve this when the child enters school. But they do that, and they have that as an option. We don't try to coerce them in any way.
Scratch skin test for a possible allergic reaction does not show anything.
People have done that with the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine just mm-hmm. because of this question of egg hypersensitivity because it's grown in an egg culture. And they've used that as a, you know, as a way to screen for that and decided that it's of no value or very little value. And the actual allergic reactions of this vaccine were probably overstated 10 or 15 years ago in terms of just the reaction to the egg vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And most people don't advocate that everybody be routinely screened for that.
Thanks.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chuck Talman, Charlie Williamson, Jana Starr. Is Jana here?
We've submitted testimony.
Right, yeah, I see her written testimony. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Chuck Talman, T-A-U-M-A-N. I'm a lawyer in Portland. I'm here with Mr. Williamson, representing the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, in favor of, I guess, hand engrossed, is that right, amendments to the present bill, House Bill 2594, which would conform it with the current Oregon law of a limitation of $500,000 for what we have called non-economic damages.
That Chair, Charles Williamson, there's no hand and gross amendments. We're just urging the committee to change on line 42 on page 2, the 250 to 500,000.
Thanks.
The we have a short videotape presentation of some discussions of the issue by a Harvard professor who was interviewed on Nightline, and then a very short excerpt of a client of mine and her mother who have suffered injuries due to vaccine reaction.
Our Boston juror is Professor Arthur Miller of the Harvard Law School, an expert on the product liability laws that have been the basis of lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers. Arthur, there is no question but that society's greater good is served by these vaccines. Probably millions of young lives have been saved in one form or another. But where does society draw the line? I mean, if the no one can force these pharmaceutical companies to go on producing, if they're being sued out of business, what happens if the government takes over? Can we sue the government?
Oh, I think we can sue the government, although we used to have a notion of sovereign immunity, that the government can do no wrong, and therefore you can't sue the king or the United States or the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Those days are behind us. If the government did take over the production of these vaccines, I'm sure that there would be a mechanism, the state or the United States government would establish an insurance pool against which people could sue. So I think the compensation system as we know it today would go on largely intact, except the defendants would be the government as producer rather than Lederle or some other drug company as producer.
All right, let's take the question this way. Some of these settlements, some of these judgments against drug companies have been enormous. Now, if a child's life is absolutely destroyed, $800,000 sounds like a lot of money for that family, as that mother just said. You know, take the money back, just give me my son back the way he ought to be. Can there be a limit imposed? Can we arbitrarily set a ceiling on how much can be awarded?
We can, but you used exactly the right word. It would be arbitrary. Let's face it, you cannot really calibrate or appraise the value of a destroyed human being, a child that's paralyzed or unable to function. Our historic approach to these problems has been, look, every citizen is an individual. That citizen has a right to go to court, to tell the court, to tell a jury of his or her peers, other citizens, what his grievance is, how he's been injured, and let the community, speaking through that jury, do its best job at appraising the value of the damage and compensate that plaintiff. And maybe if the injury was particularly grotesque, or the conduct of the corporation particularly bad, add punishment to the compensation. Any attempt to set a cap on damages by enacting some figure would be arbitrary, would be seen by citizens as another bureaucratic move, another way of protecting large corporations against individuals. And I think there would be considerable resentment against it, as well as a loss of deterrence in terms of the way corporations behave in the manufacture of their products. So there's a downside to federal legislation with an arbitrary cap on it.
All right, Mr. Johnson, you obviously don't feel that you need to be kept in check that way. You would argue that what keeps you producing the best kind of vaccine, if not the fear of litigation?
Well, several things, Ted. One is that all of the product vaccines that are produced by Letterly, our lot is approved and released by the Office of Biologicals. The standards that we have internally are met, so that and if we are grossly negligent, there are already laws in place through the FDA that would take care of that. So that to use compensation as a form of punitive action, I don't believe is the way to go.
That's naive, Ted. Let's face it, as good as the government's regulatory process may be, drugs with defects, drugs that harm, do sneak through. We've had thalidomide, we've had Bendectin, we've had DES. For those cases, we do need, I think, some form of compensation scheme. And for hundreds of years, that compensation scheme has come through the courts. And I'm not sure we should panic in the face of what may be a temporary shortage of vaccines, or what may be a temporary upsurge in litigation against drug companies. These things come and go. There are waves. And I personally feel that the imposed liability on corporate America may have crested, that we may now see a growing recognition of the need to allow corporations to manage manufacture their products without the sword of litigation daily at the back of their necks.
So, all right, let's give Mr. Johnson a quick chance to respond, and then I'll go back to Dr. Patera.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I think we're back to the point of the compensation. Nobody is questioning the case of whether you're using compensation as punishment. I don't think it's necessary, particularly in the vaccine field.
All right.
Jeanette, what do you want? What do you want? Where did you put your necklace? In the bag. In the bag. Where did you put it? In the bag. Good, Jeanette. Take the ball off the target.
I can just explain briefly as we're watching this. This is the a client of mine who was rendered severely mentally retarded and acknowledged through a injury caused by a vaccine, and there was an action filed and a recovery made both against a manufacturer and an administrator of the vaccine. The amount that was available that will have to last her the rest of her life would have been drastically reduced by a bill such as this. In fact, it would have by definition been cut in half, at least for the general damage aspect of it. You'll hear the mother, Mrs. Hansen of Portland, talking about how the injury to the daughter is one aspect of the injury that needs to be addressed, but the injury to the family, and this is something that's reflected by the submission by the Association of Retarded Citizens, that it's the injury to the family that becomes very important.
The family has been in kind of a shambles for the last 6 or 7 years. I'd like to step backward just for a moment and say one more thing that I think that we could really use if we had a little more money to spend would probably be family counseling, not only husband-wife counseling, but sibling counseling for the siblings, because I really feel like they could benefit from it a lot. I feel like we've weathered some of the worst of the storm without benefit of counseling, which might have made it better, but through our own maybe stubbornness, we have managed to stick together and weather it out just because we both believe in families and raising our own children instead of having someone else raise our children or having to separate them. But it's taken its toll. It's left its scars on our kids, too. They've had to weather some things that most other kids their age have not had to weather. They've seen their household just about torn apart from trying to cope with a situation that we totally were unprepared for. We had very little knowledge or background for, certainly no training. No one's trained to be a parent, let alone being trained to be the parent of a handicapped child.
I'd like to just comment briefly on several of the points that were made by the proponents of the bill. The purpose apparently was to account for the under-immunization of children in Oregon, whereas in fact this is a uniform bill that has been introduced in every state in the United States and is being promoted on a national basis. But more importantly, if in fact Oregon is under-immunized, and we're certainly not here to say that children should not be immunized, but certainly they should. If Oregon has a low immunization rate, there certainly is no connection or no evidence, certainly no evidence before this committee, that this bill would address that problem, which may in fact be a problem. I don't know. But there's no evidence that this bill, this drastic reduction, would address that problem. It is, in the candid words of the proponent, an attempt to short-circuit the legal system, but the Senate Judiciary Committee of the State of Oregon, I don't think, is in the business of short-circuiting the legal system. There already is a cap in this state, a cap that is quite controversial, has been declared by at least one circuit judge recently as unconstitutional. Clearly, if the cap of $500,000, which applies to all Oregon litigants, is unconstitutional. A cap of $250,000, which applies only to the most seriously injured, the most vulnerable, and the most innocent Oregon citizens, these infants who have no ability to protect themselves, is also clearly unconstitutional. The Dr. Lace mentioned situations in which vaccines are not given. What if they are given? What if a doctor, don't forget that the cap doesn't even come into play unless the plaintiff can prove that the administrator was negligent. So we have to start with the supposition that the physician has been negligent, because if the physician has not been negligent, there is no liability. This is not a question of strict liability here. If the physician has not been proven to be negligent, then there is no liability and no reason to even consider a cap. We have a situation now where the physician is negligent, as opposed to what Dr. Lace said and what he does in his practice. A physician is unaware that he should not be vaccinating a child with the pertussis vaccine, which, by the way, as I'm sure most of you know, is not a legally mandated vaccine, is not on the list of vaccines that are required to be given in this state. But a physician vaccinates an infant with pertussis vaccine when the infant has a history of seizure disorders or a family history of neurological disease. That physician, at least according to Dr. Lace, what we've heard here today, is negligent. Should that physician receive the protection, which translates into reduced insurance premiums, let's face it, of a cap on damages that is one half the cap of every single other citizen in the state of Oregon? This bill, at least as it caps liability, is unwise. It's unwise because it doesn't address a problem that has been identified. And if there is a problem, we already have national legislation which addresses this, and we have not given any chance to work. Secondly, it's clearly unfair. It penalizes and victimizes those victims of our society who are least able to protect themselves. And finally, as I said, it's unconstitutional. Our role, your role, as members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, whether you sit as practicing lawyers or under the mandate of the people of the state of Oregon, is to make a decision on constitutionality. It's not enough to say, oh, that's for the courts to do, because under our constitutional system, the legislature is a co-equal branch in determining constitutionality. Is this bill constitutional? Does it carve out a special immunity, a special privilege or immunity for a certain segment of our society? Does it punish unreasonably a certain victim, set of victims or a segment of our society? Does it deprive those victims of the right to a jury trial? Well, obviously our opinion is that it does, and I think it's incumbent upon each of you to make that decision on your own as to whether this does comport with what we know of as the rights under the Oregon Constitution. I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any questions.
Okay. Questions, Charlie? Jim Hill.
Go ahead. I just had a couple of additional points to make. The proponents indicated that this bill allows Oregon to participate in the federal system. I wanted just to correct that. We are participating in the federal system. We have to. The federal law requires that every case be submitted first to the federal government, whether it's against an administrator or against a manufacturer. They all have to go through the federal system. The only time someone would use the Oregon state law is if they got shut out of the federal system, if they said, I'm sorry, you get nothing here, or they gave a very inadequate award. And the federal system provides for attorney fees. In addition, it's a no-fault system. You don't have to prove anybody was at fault to get a federal award. So it's very unlikely that this state law is going to apply to very many people. But in the cases where it does apply, the question really is, should...
Can you do both?
You can't do both. You have to go through the federal system. The federal law precludes you from going into the state system. You can get kicked out of state court based on the federal law now.
Okay, but if you go to federal court and you don't get enough, can you come back?
You can come back. Now, the question, you know, the federal law does cap, you cannot get in the federal system more than $250,000 for your non-economic damages. Nobody is going to take anywhere reasonable federal award and risk going to Oregon courts and having to prove fault and having to pay a lawyer, most likely a contingent fee out of that award, to risk losing the federal award in order to go to state court. It's not going to happen. In the extra, if you let the injured people of Oregon that do get shut out of the federal system, assuming there are some, still sue for the $500,000 that everybody else in the state can get, that extra $250,000 is not going to be, after you finish paying your attorney and the cost and taking the risk, that extra $250,000 that you could get in state court above what your federal award would be. I mean, your federal award is in addition, the $250,000 is in addition to your lifetime medical care and other actual out-of-pocket costs, so that the extra $250,000 is going to be a very minor amount to be any kind of incentive to turn down a reasonable federal award so you can get an extra $250,000 in state court. It's just not going to produce that incentive. And we don't feel that there should be any reason to discriminate against vaccine victims and say they can't get the same level of non-economic damages that everybody else in the state can get. And, I mean, we're here basically as a matter of principle. It's not going to apply to very many people, if anyone.
Okay. Senator Hill's question.
Yeah, so just what figure did we pass out here last session?
You know, the 1987 cap that Harl Haas found unconstitutional is $500,000 for non-economic damages.
No, I mean, was this last session that we did this bill?
Oh, it was $250,000. It stayed in the bill at $250,000 last session.
Okay.
Senator Hammond?
Yeah, Charlie, this speaks to a vaccine administrator. So it's more than a physician, correct? It's a nurse. Anyone privately in a private clinic that would be administering a vaccine.
Yeah, it's whoever does it. But if I may respond, Madam Chair, that I believe that there's really, I mean, we've talked about malpractice premiums.
I tracked your rationale as far as going through the federal
yeah.
and the...
But generally, nurses that do the administration are covered under the doctor's malpractice premiums, and the pediatrician's malpractice, while it's not lowest, it's not the highest of any doctors, and it's come down substantially along with all the doctors in the last 3 or 4 years by around 30% decrease. And there's really been no testimony that, I mean, I don't think this difference, that this passage of this bill is going to make any difference in the what the premiums are for malpractice. I think the nurses would be covered by whatever the premium, by whatever the policy is that the doctor has that she's working for. And certainly if they're in a public clinic, okay, they'd be covered by the Tort Claims Act, and the public agency would cover whatever damages are.
Senator Hale has a question.
No, I don't.
Oh. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move to House Bill 3055. All the folks have been waiting nigh all day. Judith, you want to be first? We've got Mark tied up over there. Is somebody going to take your trade on that?
No, I can cover both.
You can cover both, okay. He's going to speak to the record there, into the record, unbeknownst.
Thank you.
3055, folks.
Chair Cohen, members of the committee, counsel. I'm Judith Armada, representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and I'm here to support House Bill 3055. It's a minor bill, and essentially what it does is it requires a notarized petition for withdrawal of a Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order. The Act now requires that the original petition be signed with under oath or affirmation, but there was no thought when it was originally passed to a withdrawal. And what happened here is, and Mark will probably explain that to you a little bit more, but an individual found out that somebody had assumed her identity and gone in and gotten a restraining order dismissed, and as she was no longer protected. And fortunately, her attorney was able to find out about it, and but it took some money and some time before that was reinstituted. She could have been in pretty serious danger if she had tried to enforce that order, and it didn't exist. Unless there had been a crime committed, she, of course, the police would not have responded. And I think my written testimony is before you, and unless you have any questions, I will just leave it at that.
Okay, and Mark Thorburn has worked on this issue before he came to be hired by this committee, so I suggested he follow up on that and that as part of it. So, Mark, you have comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Mark Thorburn. Before I was hired by this committee, I was a private practicing attorney here in Salem for 7 years. During that time, approximately half of my cases involved custody and child support issues. I've also served as a pro tem circuit court judge here in Marion County, handling specifically domestic relations matters. As to House Bill 3055, as it is currently written, it would prevent the reoccurrence of certain events that actually happened to one of my clients last year.